All right. It's great to be back here, and it's great to see you all. So consider a compact surface like this genus 2 surface that I've drawn on the board, and take a look at its fundamental group. So this type of thing is often called a surface group. So it's interesting often to look at representations of a surface group into some group. Like, for example, SL2R. In this talk, for the results I'll say at the end, you really need the group to be SL2R, but at the beginning it won't matter. So these sorts of representations show up all the time in geometry. In fact, they show up so often in geometry that it's tempting for me to think of them purely as geometric objects. But in recent years, people have made a lot of headway in studying these surface group representations by thinking of them instead as dynamical systems, in particular, dynamical systems over certain types of flat surfaces. And the type of dynamics on flat surfaces that have been useful here arose classically in the study, the dynamical study of the game of billiards. So today I'm just going to talk about one representation invariant, which arises from thinking about surface group representations using the dynamics of billiards on a flat surface. So I'll start off by giving you a little introduction to the game of billiards, in case you haven't played, show you how this thing gives a representation variant, do something a little more complicated to get a maybe harder to understand but much more powerful representation invariant. And then finally, if we have time, I can tell you how that representation invariant is related to a classical invariant, namely the Fock-Gontrov coordinates, which parameterize the space of representations. So billiards is traditionally played on a rectangular table. That looks like this, with some walls at the sides. So the way you play billiards is you put the ball on the table, you shoot it in some direction, and it bounces off of those walls. And other than that, it moves in straight lines. If you don't want to think about the ball reflecting off walls of the table, you can instead unfold the table over its edges to produce a larger rectangle whose opposite sides are identified. I'll label the two identified side pairs 1 and 2. So I'll call this thing the unfolded table. And the dynamics of the ball on the unfolded table are much simpler. As before, you put the ball on the table and shoot it in some direction. And instead of bouncing off the walls, it just glides through them, eventually occasionally passing through the walls and coming out on the opposite side. So this unfolded table is a polygon with its side identified by translations. And that makes it an example of what's called a translation surface. I won't say anything more about translation surfaces during the talk, but in case any of you are interested, I have a reference sheet with references for this stuff and also a lot of other stuff I'll mention in the talk that you can pick up at the end. So if you want to know more about these things I'm glossing over, ask me for a copy of that. So this is how you play billiards traditionally, but if you get bored of that, you could try playing billiards on other tables, on other shapes of tables. Now here's an example of a maybe more interesting table to play billiards on. So here is a very carefully chosen triangular table, billiard table. And I've chosen it so that when I unfold it, it unfolds into a nice octagon, again, with its sides identified, sides on opposite side of the table, or sides, sorry, opposite sides of this unfolded polygon are the ones identified with each other. So once again, we have a translation surface. Dynamics are the same as before. You put the ball somewhere on the table, you shoot it in some direction. It sort of caroms off the sides in this complicated way. And so that particular shot, I can show it to you on the unfolded table by maybe starting here and then shooting in this direction. So here we'll go through side two, come out over here, and continue on like that, around and around the table. Billiards on this table has a new feature, which is not apparent on the rectangular table. So to see the new feature, I'm going to take this ball and start it just a little in a slightly different place and shoot it. Oops, maybe I should start in a more different place and shoot it in the same direction. So I've moved the starting point of the ball just a tiny bit, shot it in the same direction, but now instead of passing through side two of the table, it passes through, or of the unfolded table, it passes through side three. And as a result, it pops out somewhere completely different. And so these two balls, their trajectories, if you shoot them at the same time, start very close to each other. But as soon as they pass on opposite sides of that corner of the table, the trajectories diverge and start acting very differently. So the new feature of this octagonal unfolded table is that nearby billiard shots, nearby trajectories, can diverge if they pass near this corner of the table. And that corner, you can distinguish it from all the others because it's the one that forms the outer vertex of this octagon. So there's something special and something bad about that outer vertex. And if you think about how this octagon is wrapped up into a surface, a flat surface, you can see what is so bad about it. But that won't be necessary for us. So this weirdness about that corner causes a problem, which is that if you shoot a ball directly into the corner, it's ambiguous what it will do. That ambiguity didn't exist on the rectangular table. So we'll just say that that outer corner of the unfolded table, those outer corners are pockets, just like in a normal billiards table. That will absorb a billiard ball if it hits them. So you don't have to worry now about the ambiguity of what happens to the ball if it hits that corner, because it just falls into the pocket and vanishes. So this makes this dynamical system of shooting billiard balls well-defined. So that's pretty much all I wanted to say about how you play billiards. Are there any questions so far?
So I would have said something like, I don't know, this octagon, and I would say, well, I have some like privilege for that. Mm-hmm. If I took like just the little angle, mm-hmm. I could have tried to wrap up like some little code point. So
yeah.
Why wouldn't I have said that is ambiguous too?
So for the particular table that I've chosen,
yeah.
I carefully chose that angle so that when you unfold it all around, you end up with an angle of 2 pi. So it's true that if you change the shape of this triangle, then you could get cone points, I think, corresponding to all of those corners.
And so what I've just said, this pocket happens to not be a pocket. Generally, it's a pocket.
Right. And I mean, so in general, the billiard table itself doesn't really matter to me, and the unfolded surface is the only thing that counts. So it's true that if you started with a differently shaped billiard table, you could get an unfolded surface, which is much more complicated. But I want to consider this nice genus 2 unfolded surface, which only has a single singularity. And yeah, as you pointed out, that singularity has a cone angle of like 6 pi around it, I think. So now I'm going to tell you how to construct a representation invariant from this game of billiards. So to construct a representation invariant, first, we need to pick a representation of our surface group, so the fundamental group of that rolled up octagon, into, let's say, SL2R. And again, it'll soon be important that it's SL2R rather than some other group. Was there a question somewhere? Yes. No question? Okay, question canceled. Great. See, I already answered it. So just to get a nice set of generators for this fundamental group, let me fix that point as the base point. And then for each side of the octagon, I have a natural choice of a loop that goes from the base point to itself. So there are going to be 4 loops. I might as well draw the 4th one. And I'll just label those loops the same as I label the sides. I'll label them 1, 2, 3, and 4. So I can describe this representation by saying that each loop 1 through 4 gets sent to some SL2R operator, A1 through A4. Sorry? Oh, the relations. They're the I can't write it down. So there's a single relation, just like you would normally get for the fundamental group. And it's some weird zigzag among those things that I can't say off the top of my head. So
Does the presence of the pocket somehow affect your radiation?
That's a good point. Yeah, I should say, for now, I'm puncturing out the pocket. So you can really think of this as a representation of a free group. The surface group will be free. But, there's no reason, if you want to, you can pick a representation that obeys that relation, and then you'll have a representation on the surface itself. Or like the case you might be particularly interested in is picking a representation where there's holonomy -1 around that puncture. And so you get to a moduli space with the same dimension as the moduli space of ordinary representations, but now you have these twisted representations. Or like almost abelian representations, as I think Andy calls them. But yeah, just think free group for now. So punctured surface. So I picked a representation. And as a next step toward generating a representation invariant, I'm going to fix a direction in the octagon to shoot the billiard balls in. So I'm going to stop worrying about which direction to shoot the balls and just worry about the places on the octagon where the balls start moving. And then I'll just always shoot in the same direction. And so the direction that I've drawn in that picture is something like that. So as a technicality, in order to make the dynamics of this billiards good, you need to pick a generic direction. What does generic mean? Well, for example, You should make sure that there's no shot, which connects two pockets. So you shouldn't be able to shoot from this pocket directly into that one. And there are also some other conditions, which I don't want to state because they're more complicated. So not all shooting directions will work, but like a measure one set of shooting directions will be fine. So if you just pick one at random, you'll be fine with probability one. So we've picked a representation in a shooting direction. And now we're going to modify the game of billiards as follows. On your billiard ball, you should put some vector in R2. And then as your ball glides across the table, you should let these representation, these SL2R elements that you picked, act on it. So for example, if the ball glides across side 2 of the table, then you should take that vector V the ball is carrying and turn it into A2 acting on V. So now you've taken this dynamical system where billiard balls are bouncing around, and you've also added some vectors, which are getting carried along by the balls and moving around, corresponding to your representation. So to describe mathematically what's going on here, I'm going to make a function big psi from octagon cross R into SL2R. And so if I pick a starting point x, then this curve psi x t describes the motion of any vector. I should say motion of all vectors carried by some ball, which you shot starting from x. So that function, that operator will jump every time the billiard ball trajectory crosses through a side of the polygon. OK. Are there any questions here? OK. So here's an example of a representation that you might choose, just so we have something concrete. So for an example representation, I've drawn pictures corresponding to these four generators, A1, A2, A3, A4. And these pictures describe some operators in SL2, and they describe them in sort of a weird way, which I'll now explain. So let's take the picture for A2. So here I've drawn a frame for R2. And I'm going to say that this operator A2 is the thing that takes this cone, which I've decorated with stripes, and sort of like sucks it outwards so that the cone expands and then everything in it gets sort of sucked in towards the origin, with the net result that everything inside of that stripy cone gets expanded out and sucked inwards to become this whole quadrant. And the same thing, of course, happens over here. So everything here gets, gets expanded out and sucked in to become that quadrant. And then in these other quadrants with the dotted cones, the opposite thing happens. In this other quadrant, everything gets smashed down so that these two lines collapse onto the edges of that dotted cone. And the whole quadrant gets smashed into the dotted cone and sort of shoved outwards. So that's what this transformation looks like. And the other pictures are interpreted similarly. This is sort of a weird way of drawing these operators. So there are questions. Are there questions about that? Is it clear what these operators are doing? OK. So an interesting feature of this example representation is that it has a sort of directionality. In other words, everything, no matter which generators you pick, no matter which operators A1 through A4 you pick, all of them are more or less taking the stuff up in this quadrant and like sucking it down toward the origin. And then on the other hand, all of the as operators are taking the stuff in these two quadrants and blowing it outwards towards infinity. So there's a rough directionality to all of these that all of these generators have in common. And in fact, you can even say something more precise. That directionality fits together nicely with the sort of inherent directionality of our numbered generators for the fundamental group of the octagon. So here's what I mean by that. So like I said before, we've fixed a shooting direction, a direction to shoot the billiard balls in the octagon. And that means that if you follow a billiard ball's path around the octagon, you're going to be passing through these sides in a particular direction. You're always going to be passing outwards through these copies of the sides, and then always going inward through the other copies. And you can see that that directionality matches up with the loops that I drew. So if you shoot a billiard ball and play this game, the only operators you'll be applying are A1 through AN, never their inverses. So you can ask, what if you take a particular billiard trajectory and just look at the sequence of operators that you get from that trajectory? So for example, if you take this example trajectory from earlier, you first do A3, and then you pass through side 1 and do A1, and then I believe you'll end up, then you'll end up hitting side 4, or something like that, and so on. So let me write that down just for reference. So you've got this particular billiard trajectory, starting at a point X, and the sequence of operators that corresponds to it is A1, A3, A4, and so on. So let's take a look at what that sequence of operators does using pictures like this. Was there, is that a question or just, hold up, never mind. Okay, sorry. All right, so the first operator, A1, we already have a picture of what that thing does. That thing takes this particular cone, this stripy cone, and expands it out into that quadrant, like we said before. Now, if you do A1, and then A3, what does that do? Well, once you do A1, this whole thing is going to be expanded out into the full quadrant, and then inside of it, some other cone is going to get expanded out. So I can draw the A3 cone squashed down inside of the A1 cone. It looks something like this. And now we can see that the net effect of doing A1 and then A3 is to take this smaller cone and expand it out until it becomes this full quadrant. So next, if you do A4, the same thing happens. You can identify an even smaller, even thinner A4 cone inside of the A3 cone. And the net effect of doing A1 and then A3 and then A4 is to take this tiny thin cone and expand it out to become that whole quadrant. And you can keep doing this over and over. And because these cones will always be nested inside of each other, you see eventually that they converge to a line, which I'll call E plus. Which, if you follow any Billiard trajectory, or if you follow this particular Billiard, sorry, not any, that's important. If you follow this particular Billiard trajectory, always stays in this contracting quadrant. And because it's staying in that contracting quadrant, because everything is getting expanded out around it, that line will end up shrinking exponentially. So we've got this special line A3 that was defined by the dynamics of a billiard ball starting at that point x. And because we got the sequence of operators by starting at a certain point in the octagon, I'll label this line EX to remember that we started in a particular place. And just to give this thing a name, I'll call this thing a shrinking line. Yes, so we'll get to that in a little bit later in the talk. But this is an excellent question to ask yourself in the meantime. If you're bored, you can ask yourself, how exactly does the shrinking line change as you move around your starting point? And you can see already that if you move your starting point across one of those corners, something bad is going to happen. Okay.
Right.
So at the beginning, so over there. So this whole thing, this everything I've been saying since we started here has been a big recipe for a representation invariant, and one of the ingredients was fixing a shooting direction. So indeed, this will depend on the direction, but I've decided to fix a direction and never worry about it again. So it's also very interesting to ask what happens to these things as you change the direction, but I'm not going to talk about that. Well, I might talk about it at the end, but not now. So from over there, we've seen that the example representation has a cool property, which I will now formalize. So for every starting point x in the octagon, you can find some line E plus x with the following property. So I said roughly that the thing that characterizes E plus X is that it stays in that contracting quadrant, so that vectors in that line shrink exponentially as you go forwards. So a more formal way to say that is that if you look at the size of some vector being carried along by a billiard ball, and compare it to its original size, you can see the exponential shrinking by taking the logarithm of that ratio and then normalizing it somehow. And the thing that characterizes the shrinking line is the fact that as you let time go on very long, you'll see this thing shrinking. You know, that ratio is shrinking exponentially. So when you renormalize it like that, you end up with a particular number. And of course, this characterizes that line, the shrinking line E plus. So this thing is true for vectors in the shrinking line. Now, here's something I didn't mention. If you take the billiard balls and you shoot them backwards, exactly backwards along your chosen direction, then basically everything in this story is the same, except that the role of these stripy regions, the stripy cones, is instead played by the speckled cones. So if you shoot the billiard ball backwards, it's now the speckled cones which get expanding outwards. And so you'll end up with some shrinking line that lies inside nested copies of the speckled cones. So this dynamics not only shows that this representation has these nice forward shrinking lines, but also some other lines, which I'll call backward shrinking lines, and I'll label them E minus. And because everything is the same when you go backwards, this statement is also true for vectors in the backward shrinking lines. So you now have two families of lines that you get from these dynamics. That's a good question. Yes, they have to be distinct. And the reason is that if they coincided, then you would have some vectors which were, it's a little complicated. Under good conditions, you can show that if sort of some vectors are shrinking, then everything else has to be expanding, because the norms of the sequences you get have to be growing and growing exponentially. So if the two lines were the same, then you would end up with everything shrinking, something like that. Under good conditions, they're always distinct.
And is lambda the same for both?
Yes, and that's important. And this comes from the same thing I said, and the fact that they're always distinct, and I can't say exactly why it's always the same. Roughly speaking, it has to do with the fact that you're in SLN, so if something expands in one way, then to preserve volumes, you have to shrink by the same amount in the other way. But to make sense of that statement, you have to be careful about, the angles between those two different lines, and that it gets complicated. So this is a cool property that our representation has. And under good dynamical conditions, so if we choose the shooting direction well, if we get lucky with probability 1 with the shooting direction, then this is equivalent to a well-studied dynamical property. Which is called uniform hyperbolicity. That's an excellent question. I'm glad I planted somebody in the audience to ask that. You'll get your $20 later. So here's a fact. Is that even though those shrinking lines do depend wildly on the starting point x, the lambda doesn't. And the reason for this, roughly speaking, is that, this is going to be very rough. If you choose that shooting direction well, then you're basically just passing through these sides at random. You can imagine, for example, just picking sequences of operators a1 through a4 by choosing them uniformly at random. And then you can sort of imagine that each operator expands stuff by a certain amount, roughly speaking. And then when you average over lots of those operators, then everything averages out to the same numbers, or to the same number by the ergodic theorem. That argument is probably probably doesn't actually work in any way, but this is at least the way I think of why this should be true. And the reason that the lines do jump around is because, for the lines, there can be no such averaging out thing. The lines sort of depended sensitively on which order we picked the cones in. whereas the amount that we grow sort of only depended on sort of the rough amount of growing that each operator does. So that number lambda doesn't depend on the start point x, but it does depend on your representation. So that number lambda it's called the Lyapunov exponent. And the Lyapunov exponent is the representation invariant that I promised that I would construct for you. So this is great. Out of this dynamical situation where we were shooting billiard balls around on our unfolded table, we got an invariant of these representations of the fundamental group of the unfolded table. It's that number, the Lyapunov exponent, and has a really nice dynamical interpretation. But you might be sort of unsatisfied by this, because we did an awful lot of work to come up with this invariant, and in the end, the invariant is just one number. So you might say, since we've put in all of this work already, can we do some sort of tweaks to make this invariant more powerful, to get more information about the representation out of all of this dynamical work that we did? And the answer is that we can. Here's an idea for how to do it. So in order to find those Lyapunov exponents, we found all of these lines corresponding to various billiard ball starting points, these forward and backward shrinking lines, e plus and minus x. But then when we took the Lyapunov exponent, we just threw away all of those lines. And so you might say, hey, wait, those lines contain a ton of information clearly about the representation, so we should keep those. We should make those part of our invariant. Unfortunately, there's a problem with this idea. Which is that, as somebody pointed out earlier, those forward and backward shrinking lines depend on your starting point, and they depend in a really nasty way. So here's the reason why. The reason has to do with this feature that we saw at the beginning, the fact that trajectories can diverge as they pass on either side of one of those corners. So let me draw here a fresh octagon. Let's see, that's a good question. I don't know.
Your argument with like, oh, it, roughly speaking, I'm just yeah. playing in some random order.
Yeah.
I would have thought, and just speaking like the log average logs of the eigen.
I don't know, like, it should be something like that, but I don't know whether you can actually get it by doing precisely that calculation. So if you literally just computed the eigenvalues of those operators or their norms or something like that, and then averaged them over the sequence, I'm not sure if you would get the Lyapunov exponent exactly right. You would? Yeah.
I think I've admit that the model that the transport the time t log of the transport size is a matrix.
Right. So that is true. But like the here you're not looking at the norm of the operator, but rather you're looking at what it does to a particular vector. And so that's the concern, right? You can't say that this the change in this ratio is just given by, you know, the large eigenvalue, for example, because this vector won't shrink as much as a large eigenvector will shrink. Or sorry, it won't. Yeah.
I guess I could have, one way that I could have told my, like, these are representations of a free group. I would change one of the names a little bit, the eigenvites.
Yes.
And you're telling me that, like, that's very
different. Well, so it can be very different. I believe under good circumstances, the exponent should change continuously as you vary the matrices.
But
it will change, yes.
So that it's not just a stupid fact.
Yes. I'm sorry?
Are there periodic trajectories?
No. And the reason is because of this technicality. So when I said choose a shooting director at random, in particular, although it's far from obvious, the fact that no shot connects two pockets, if I remember right, guarantees that there can't be any periodic trajectory. And that's sort of a fun, like, that's a non-trivial fact about translation surface. Okay, so here's the problem that you get when you try to keep track of those shrinking lines instead of just keeping track of the Lyapunov exponent. So I've drawn here on the surface some examples of trajectories that go into these pockets. Those things I'll call critical trajectories. Those critical trajectories are the ones that fall into pockets. And so if you take your billiard ball starting point across a critical trajectory, then as we saw before, those paths can diverge wildly, and that means the sequences of matrices can be very different, which means very different shrinking lines. So you're going to have a sort of sharp change in your forward shrinking line every time you go across one of those critical trajectories. Okay, so keeping track of those lines is not a good idea. You'd have to keep track of a large amount of data, which is analytically really badly behaved. But fortunately, this problem has a solution, which was come up with by Gayoto, Moore, and Naitsky, and which you can also see in the work of Bonahon. And Dreyer. And the solution is this. So first, roughly speaking, what you should do is cut and glue your representation. So cut up the representation of that surface, cut up the surface and change it along the cuts. To line up those lines E plus and E minus, the forward and backward shrinking lines, across all of the different points. So before we had these lines that are varying wildly every time you go across a critical trajectory. But now I'm gonna say, okay, I just wanna cut my surface at every critical trajectory and just by hand change the representation so those lines are lined up with each other. And when that happens, you're taking this representation of SL2R, which you can think of if you want as a flat vector bundle, and you're splitting it into a direct sum of two representations. Each of which is just a line, which is acted on by GL1. The GL1 is just telling you how each shrinking line expands and shrinks as you go around the surface. So when you do this cutting and gluing to line up the lines, this SL2R rep splits into two representations, two GL1 representations. And that pair of DL1 representations is easy to describe. You have, if you want to think about them as vector bundles, you have a pair of flat GL1 vector bundles. And a flat vector bundle doesn't take much data at all to describe. So this really nasty data of these wildly changing shrinking spaces, you can turn into something much nicer, much more algebraic, which is just a pair of flat vector bundles. So at this point, I should ask, so I was told that I should prepare a 1-hour talk, but that the seminar is supposed to go for like 1.5 hours max. So should I be planning sort of to talk until roughly 3:15, 3:20-ish? Like, okay. All right, if you all want, then I will just, all right, I'll just do this last part in a sort of slightly more leisurely way than I usually do. So once you have that idea, there's another problem that you run into, which is that these critical leaves, as you follow them around the surface, they keep winding around and winding around. And in fact, they wind around the surface densely, just like all the Billiard trajectories. Well, of course, that's no surprise, because these things, these critical trajectories, follow the same paths as Billiard trajectories. They just happen to be the Billiard trajectories that go into the pockets. So you have this problem that these critical trajectories for a generic shooting direction will wind around and around in that octagon and fill it up densely. So when I say cut and glue this representation, you're going to have to do a lot of cutting and a lot of gluing. The octagon will get completely shredded, and you have to then put it back together somehow. So thinking of these representations as flat vector bundles, I should say, although it's maybe the right idea to think about the beginning and end products, it's not the thing you should probably be thinking about when you think about doing this cutting and gluing. Fortunately, this problem also has a solution. Via some topological trickery. So the solution is to take each critical trajectory. So here's an example of one critical trajectory which hits a corner of the octagon, and then in that corner of the octagon reappears in other places and has other critical trajectories coming off of it. So we're going to take that critical trajectory, into lanes. So what I mean is you should think of this, if that critical trajectory is like a dirt road, then I want to expand it into a nice modern two-lane road. With a left lane and a right lane. And also gluing them together, a median strip in the middle. And so you can take the surface, you know, your original topological surface, and split it up like this. So you get a new topological surface, which has nice properties. For example, it's still locally compact and stuff like that. Although you lose some things, like it's no longer Hausdorff, because you have these infinitesimally separated paths. But you can get a new topological surface, which has some nice dynamics on it that mirror the dynamics on the original surface. And in many ways, the dynamics are nicer, because the splitting of each trajectory into left and right lanes, that breaks the ambiguity about what happens to a billiard ball when it hits exactly in a corner. You can now say that a billiard ball following that left lane goes the way left, slightly to the left billiard balls would go, and a ball following the right lane goes the way slightly to the right balls would go. And then the median, you can, as before, let it terminate at the pocket. So this topological trick buys you something useful, which is that you can now say, that if you start a billiard ball on this critical road, you get a well-defined forward shrinking line for balls starting in the left lane, and also a well-defined forward shrinking line for balls starting in the right lane. And if you look on the median, although, of course, you don't have a forward shrinking line associated to that because the median just terminates at the pocket, if you follow the median backwards, then it winds around and around without problems. So this is one of the reasons it's useful to rule out trajectories that connect two pockets. This tells you that if you're on a critical road, if it's critical in one direction, in the forward direction, then in the backward direction, it just winds around forever like normal. So on one of these critical roads, you have three instead of two nicely defined lines. You have a forward shrinking line for the left lane, a forward shrinking line for the right lane, and a backward shrinking line, which is shared between the left and right lanes and also the median. So now I can say, to cut and glue my surface, or to cut and glue my representation, what I should do is cut it down the medians, so left and right lanes are separated. And then, every time I cross the road from the left lane to the right lane, I should do the automorphism. I should insert into my representation this automorphism that takes the left shrinking line to the right shrinking line and is the identity on the median line. So I'll call that automorphism the jump associated with that critical trajectory. And so now, if I have a loop in my octagon, in order to carry out this cutting and gluing, to figure out what the holonomy of that loop is after the cutting and gluing, all I have to do is follow the path, and every time I cross a critical leaf, I just apply one of those jumps. And of course, I'm going to have to apply a lot of them because these critical leaves, again, fill the surface densely. But so you're going to have to apply a lot of jumps, and so you may have some analytical worries about, for example, whether the holonomy, this cut-and-glued holonomy, actually converges. But fortunately, I was able to show in my thesis that these cut-and-glued holonomies they, first of all, do converge. And second of all, they do actually line up the shrinking subspaces as you would expect. So long story short, this idea of Gajardo, Mora, and Knightsky, and Bonhon and Trier this idea of lining up those shrinking lines to turn your nasty, varying everywhere shrinking lines into some much nicer flat bundles really does work and gets you a more powerful representation invariant, namely this pair of flat GL1 bundles. So, so this resulting pair of GL1 representations, which I'll call E plus and E minus ab for abelianized, are called the abelianized version of the representation. And they give a more powerful representation invariant. So how powerful is it? Well, here's what I expect, which is proven in a lot of cases. I just haven't managed to prove it in the full generality presented here. So in the many cases where this is known, this is either from the work of Guido Moore, Hollins, and Nitzke, or it's from like some classical work in hyperbolic geometry done by Bonohon and Dreyer. So the expectation, which is proven in many cases, is that this abelianized representation is a complete invariant if you fix the holonomy around each singularity of the Billiard table around each pocket at -1, for example. It may actually be true if you just, you know, fix the holonomies to whatever, but I can only say for certain that if you fix the holonomies at each pocket around each pocket at -1, once you fix that stuff, those holonomies, then the abelianized representation should, and does in many cases, tell you everything about the original representation. So this is a really powerful invariant. And because it is related to these Lyapunov exponent, this much simpler invariant that I described earlier, you might ask, can you extract the Lyapunov exponent from this fancier gadget, this abelianized representation? And the answer is that now if we have our hands on these abelianized representations, now we can do what you wanted to do and say, I can extract the Lyapunov exponent by just taking those representations, holonomies, and averaging them along long trajectories. So the reason that works this time is because, so we asked before, okay, how come you can't just take like the norms of these operators or their eigenvalues or something like that and average those? And the answer was, because you have to worry about exactly which direction, which vector you're looking at, and that vector won't generally be an eigenvector. And the information of what vector you need to look at is contained precisely in these wildly varying shrinking subspaces. And once we line up the shrinking subspaces into, so each shrinking subspace becomes its own flat representation, its own flat bundle or representation, then we can just, you know, cruise along and follow the shrinking representations and see where the vectors go. So this sort of really fancy gadget, this abelianized representation, contains easily, in an easily accessible way, this much more straightforward and friendly invariant, which is the Lyapunov exponent that you're already familiar with. All right, so that was everything I had planned to say. And so there is two options. One is that you can stop me now and start grilling me. And the other option is that, oh, sorry, erase my plan. The other option is that I can tell you how these things are related, these abelianized representations are related to Fuch-Goncharov coordinates. And yeah, okay, votes. Did anybody want to see right now about Fuch-Goncharov coordinates? A couple people. And does anybody want to stop for questions right now? All right, if there are no questions, then I'll just move on to these.
So I do have a question.
Yes.
So, do you have anything to say about representations that don't have all of their negative eigenvectors sort of in the same plane?
Right. So this property, which unfortunately I just started erasing, this uniform hyperbolicity property, I should have mentioned that's a property that you need in order to do this abelianization process. So abelianization only works on representations which have this property. The good news is that that property is sort of more general than this situation that I described in an example. So this example situation is an example. So the place I got this representation was just by taking like a hyperbolic structure on that octagon and then looking at the holonomies of that hyperbolic structure. And so that gave a representation where, like you said, you have these sort of nicely lined up eigendirections. And because it came from hyperbolic geometry in this way, this representation actually has a much stronger property called the Anosov property. So, well, okay, I shouldn't say more about that because I don't know precise statements. But so this sort of lining up of subspaces, that's a strong property. It's really, you know, it gives you an example of things with the Anosov property. But you can also sort of, you can have weaker things that still work. So for example, if I threw in like some elliptics, which only rotated which only were small rotations, that I think would typically break the Anosov property. But if you make the rotations small enough and have them happen infrequently enough as you pass through the walls of the octagon, then you can still get this uniform hyperbolicity in some directions. So yeah, you don't need sort of this precisely this situation where you have a bunch of lining up eigendirections, but you can imagine you need something like close to that, or at least something that looks close to that if you go along a particular direction. And yeah, I think there is a question about whether you can extend this invariant to things that just don't have the uniform hyperbolicity property at all. I don't think there's anything I can say about that. So if you ask Andy Knightsky, he'll say you should be able to like analytically continue this somehow so it goes outside that region, but I don't know how to think about that.
I guess I could have asked, not every matrix is real.
Oh, yes, right. So can you extend this to SLC? That I can answer. Yes, I'm almost 100% sure, given that a few technical results carry over to SLC, which they should. And there the, roughly speaking, instead of thinking of eigendirections like clustering together on the unit circle, you can think of them clustering together on the Riemann sphere. You can get an example of uniformly hyperbolic representations by taking a bunch of matrices whose eigendirections on the Riemann sphere are sort of close enough. And then instead of having cones in, R2, you'll have cones in R3 that give you those sort of shrinking cones. There's a name for them. I think they're called like Alexandreev cones or something like that, but I don't remember exactly. So let's see. Yes.
Another question is for you, Cohen. Can you say a little bit more for your topological track? We made this construction of a new surface, cutting all along.
Yes.
Can you say a little more in a little more detail what is good and bad about this creepy surface that's not outdoor, but locally?
Okay. So this I'm doing from memory. I didn't prep, so there could be problems here. But if you want precise statements, I can show you, like I can look those up after the talk. But if you just want
some
okay. So there's really three surfaces that you should be considering. So you've got this original surface. And then you've got what I would call the divided surface, like think divided highway. And then third, you've got the surface which is exactly the same as the divided surface, but you remove the medians. So that thing I call the fractured surface. Because once you remove those medians, for example, you destroy local connectedness, and you get something which is completely shredded. So when I said earlier that, you know, doing this cutting and gluing like completely shreds the surface, this is like an expression of that. This is what the surface gets shredded up into. So yeah, let's compare and contrast these different surfaces. So this original surface, of course, looks locally like R2, except at the singularities. This divided surface is not really sort of locally anything good. But the fractured surface is locally something good. This is locally R crossed with a Cantor set. So why is it good to work with surfaces that are locally R2? Well, that sort of much is obvious. These are sort of geometrically nice. These are the things that we're used to dealing with in geometry. You might say it's our ultimate goal to study surfaces like that. But if you're a dynamicist, then a thing that's locally a Cantor set is also really nice. Because Cantor sets are, you know, just as R is like one of the simplest spaces you can have in geometry, a Cantor set is one of the simplest spaces you can have in dynamics. So this fractured surface is really friendly from a dynamical perspective. In particular, so this surface is, so let me see here. So this surface that you start with is compact, sort of except at the punctures. And this surface that you get, which is R cross a Cantor set, because the Cantor set is compact, turns out to be just compact, period. So this is like a thing that is really used like in all this technical stuff to show that this procedure works. The fact that the surface is compact turns out to be very useful. So the surface is compact, and it's also, because the Cantor set is Hausdorff, this thing is also Hausdorff. So it has lots of really nice topological properties. So roughly speaking, this surface is geometrically nice. This surface is dynamically nice. And I should also say There is well-defined dynamics, well-defined and well-behaved dynamics, which lift the billiard dynamics on the original surface. So I said before, a reason you would do this splitting dynamically is to, you know, lift the ambiguity of where a billiard ball goes when it hits a corner. And here, you've just completely broken the ambiguity. So billiard balls, when they hit the corner, either go left or they go right, which is, you know, that choice is what gives you the Cantor set. And that means that here you have like this beautiful, well-behaved dynamics on a surface with these nice topological properties that tell you about the dynamics on the original surface, which were not so well-behaved. So the original surface is geometrically nice. The fractured surface is dynamically nice. And then this divided surface is useful as a bridge between them. I mean, it's topologically, it's very nasty, but it has one important topological property, which this one lacks, which is, although it's non-Hausdorff, it's not Hausdorff, it's dynamically inconvenient. It has all of these problems, but it has the major saving grace that it is locally connected. And in particular, that means that there are sort of nice results that you can get about locally constant sheaves. So local systems on this surface are easy to work with. And they pretty much match the local systems on the original surface. In fact, I think if I remember right, there's a result that says like the local systems on this surface are exactly the local systems on the original surface, maybe if you make some constraints, but I forgot what the constraints were, so I don't want to state anything clearly. But basically, this thing is useful because if you think of your representations as local systems, then this surface, which gives you a bridge to the dynamically nice fractured surface, you can work directly on it with the same representations. So basically, you can work with representations living on this surface, and then when you need to do some dynamics, you just forget about the medians, and you easily get access to the fractured surface from the divided one. Okay, yeah.
About the picture, like,
yeah.
There's an inclusion here and a projection here, right?
Let me see, so where and where?
Inclusion from right to middle, is that right?
So let's see. Yes, there's definitely inclusion here. Yes, so that's also true. In fact, there's a quotient map, if I remember right. And moreover, although it's not, well, okay, sorry, I should be careful here. Yes, you have to, well, it's, I mean, it's okay at the roundabouts. It's at the roundabouts, it's just you have like three different, or like six different points or whatever going down to the same singularity. Yeah, it's 1-to-1 away from the critical leaves. It's 3-to-1 on the critical leaves, and then yeah, at the roundabouts, like I do something, I like make a convention which I can't remember, but yeah, you're right that the roundabouts are funny. I should mention there's one more thing which you might not expect, which is that there is also an inclusion like that, which is certainly not is it continuous? I'm pretty sure. Okay, there's an inclusion like that. If I remember correctly, that inclusion is actually continuous. Which is not, doesn't feel right, unless you think about like the bizarre topology that is defined on that surface. And
these,
so yeah, the fractured surface inclusion is definitely continuous. That quotient map is, yeah, I believe that's also continuous. And so in particular, when you want to go between local systems on these surfaces, the way you do it is by using, you know, you push forward along that surjection, but you can also push forward along the inclusion, which you don't expect. And so that gives you this correspondence between local systems.
It's including into the median.
Exactly. So you take the surface, you include into the median, and because you've removed those corners anyway, because you've removed the pockets, you don't have to worry about, you know, normally you'd have to worry about, okay, this pocket, does it go like up to here or up to there, or like you have six choices? But if you remove the pockets, then you don't have to make any choice. Okay. More questions about that? Should I spend a couple minutes mentioning Fakhrunchev coordinates? All right. So number four, which I'll just really vaguely sketch. So this relationship with Kupfer-Kontrov coordinates, this is from this older work of Gaido, Moore and Naitsky. And so in the work where they originally came up with this idea, they were considering representations on punctured surfaces. And by punctured, I don't just mean like a surface with those pockets removed, but I mean that we're working on these translation surfaces. So just think site-identified polygons. With what I'll call cylindrical ends. And so geometrically, a cylindrical end, you can think of it as just a cylinder that's like shooting off into space from your surface. And so if you have a trajectory on the surface, a billiard ball trajectory, that billiard ball can end up spiraling up the cylinder and just vanish into infinity. And in fact, every billiard ball, unless it goes into a pocket, will suffer that fate. So on a translation surface with cylindrical ends, billiard balls have two options. They can either shoot off to infinity or they can go into a pocket, and there's nothing else that can happen. Which I guess means that if you play billiards on a surface like this, you have to be either a really good shot or you have to have a lot of spare billiard balls. So this means that the dynamics on these surfaces, at least in terms of what things do after a very long time, is super duper simple. And one way to see that is by looking at sort of like a flat picture. Of one of these surfaces with cylindrical ends. So if you take a surface with cylindrical ends like this, and you look at what trajectories do at infinity, what you'll see is big bundles of trajectories. So you'll see one trajectory that goes off into a certain cylindrical end, and then every nearby trajectory will go off into the same end. And so those trajectories will bundle together into a big strip. And then eventually you'll find one trajectory, a critical trajectory, that goes into a pocket. And there'll be some other trajectories coming out of that pocket as well. And once you cross over that critical trajectory, then you'll see another strip, another big bundle of trajectories that go off into a different cylindrical end. And you can do this all across the surface. So before we had a surface that was sort of all in one piece, the trajectories just sort of blended together densely, and it was sort of all freaky. But if you have these cylindrical ends, the game of billiards gets much simpler because all trajectories after a long time just go into one of the cylindrical ends. And that splits the whole surface up into strips. So where before we had this freaky dynamical problem, now the question of computing these shrinking lines is just a combinatorial problem. So the picture that I like to have in my head is here I drew a flat picture. Here I drew this sort of just topological, this evocative sketch. And I'm going to draw a third picture, a conformal picture, where each of those strips I will conformally shrink it down into a diamond like this. So let's see, can I do this right? I think I can. So if I've drawn this correctly, I hope these pictures match. So here I've got three strips, which I'll label maybe 1, 2. And I should put some direction markers. So let's say these trajectories are all flowing in the upward direction. Like that. So now within the bundle, if you now start thinking of this representation seriously as a flat bundle, so now within the bundle, sort of near these points, the cylindrical endpoints, which I've shrunk down conformally to punctures, like single punctures, here you have some shrinking lines as before, and you just get one for each big bundle of trajectories, one for each strip. So here's the shrinking line for 2. For strip 2. Sorry, forward shrinking line for strip 2. Forward shrinking line for 1. And here's a shared shrinking line. So the shared backwards shrinking line for 1 and 2. And now if you put those things together, if, for example, you stand right on the boundary between those two strips, there you can see all three shrinking lines. Whoops. Could you ask again?
The reason it's shared is because it's like I could read off from something about
the. Yes. So these shrinking lines. So yeah, I should be a little careful. To see these shrinking lines in the way that we did, in order to, you know, as like the lines that shrink according to some metric. To do that in this situation, you have to be careful about how the metric is defined near the punctures, because you're no longer on a compact surface. A cheap way to think about it, if you don't want to think about that harmonic metric, which turns out to be the right thing, is to just say that these are eigenvectors of the monodromy around the punctures. So now using these three lines, you can just make the same jump automorphism as before. And so now it's clear that, so again, in the dynamical case, in the case that was dynamically interesting, we had just this, you know, bizarre collection of shrinking lines that are varying wildly as you go around the surface. But in this dynamically nice case, this sort of dynamically trivial case that Gadamer and Naitsky originally considered, you just have a finite set of shrinking lines, which just give a nice configuration inside the total space of the bundle. So the dynamics again, this sort of weird dynamics and analysis collapses down to some nice, neat combinatorics. And now, I can show, so, okay, this picture I may not be able to draw off the top of my head, but I'll try to do it in the last couple. Okay, I have a minute or two, and that's maybe just enough time to draw this picture. Well enough. So if you take a surface like this, which is constructed in a certain way, so it has to be a double cover. I mean, if you're familiar with the work of Guido Morinitsky, it's the spectral curve. But you can take a translation surface, which has a certain automorphism, which makes it a double cover of what's called a half translation surface. And if you have that particular type of surface, then inside of it, instead of just strips, you can find configurations of strips, which look really nice. These are configurations of strips that make nice annuli. So let's see, this should look like that, sort of. Okay, so should I add some more detail here? Then what I want to see, so the idea is that each of these things I've drawn, for example, this thing, is a strip that's really stretched out and distorted, so you can see sort of a full annulus worth of strips. And there should be somewhere, let's see, right. Okay, sorry, I've drawn this picture slightly wrong somehow, but this is sort of roughly the configuration you get. And so you've got this annulus worth of strips. You've got a whole bunch of shrinking lines. I colored this thing incorrectly. No, wait, maybe I didn't. Okay. Sorry about that. So on this picture, you can see a couple of vertices, or a couple of cylindrical ends where these critical trajectories all plunge into. And in each of those cylindrical ends, you'll have some shrinking line. So you get a nice configuration of shrinking lines. And then it turns out that the holonomy around the annulus of this abelianized local system, once you do the cutting and gluing, is the same as the cross ratio of the shrinking lines that you encounter around the annulus. So you can see sort of around this inside of the annulus, you have four lines. Around the outside, you also have four lines. If your representation is like invariant with respect to the automorphism that I sort of said you had to have here, then these four lines are the same as those four lines. And if you take the cross ratio of those four lines, it turns out you get that holonomy. And if you draw this picture carefully and you just sort of go around like moving one line to the other, then you can see really explicitly that you are computing the cross ratio in a geometric way by shuffling around lines. And so, if you've got a surface that's split up combinatorially and it's got some punctures with lines attached to them and you start taking cross ratios of those lines, if you're familiar with Fock-Gontrov coordinates, then you might say, that sounds like Fock-Gontrov coordinates. And indeed, if you work out all the details, which I don't have time to do right now, you'll see that those cross ratios are precisely the Fock-Gontrov coordinates associated with this splitting of the surface into strips, which gives you a triangulation in a certain way. All right, so that was very briefly how this sort of dynamical looking representation invariant, this abelianized local system or abelianized representation, is really just a souped up version of Fock-Gontrov coordinates, which is defined on compact surfaces, where in Fock-Gontrov coordinates you had a triangulation, or equivalently this dual triangulation, in the dynamical case, in the compact case, you have this big mess of critical leaves of the dynamics, or critical trajectories of the dynamics, which play the role, the same role as the dual triangulation. And that's all I have to say for now. So thank you for coming. Thank you. Okay. So yeah, if anybody wants a copy of that reference sheet, then I have a couple, which should be just enough. Assuming I can find them.
Asking possibly further questions about this concept of function. If you ran into a sample.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think about it like every state? What the level of this? What the part of the
instruments? Ooh. I have no idea. So, man. So yeah, I mean, as you probably know, there is certainly such a thing as quantum billiards, and like you get really interesting things out of it. And oh, yeah, okay, that's a thing I can say then. I mean, you can. This is sort of, is it straightforward? Like you can. Okay, I don't know if it's straightforward. Like there's definitely such a thing as quantum billiards. I want to say that you should be able to sort of figure out yourself how to play it just by taking ordinary billiards, which is just a particle moving in Rn, and quantumifying it. And more precisely, well, I don't want to make guesses about how you do this because you could look at it up in some book. But you get really, so you can get cool things out of that. So for instance, if you take the classical limit in sort of the typical way in quantum mechanics, and you draw the, you know, draw pictures of the wave vectors that you get, the state vectors, if you draw them on that unfolded table or whatever, if you draw it on the table itself, you can see those things actually like converging to, I think, sort of classical looking trajectories, if I remember right. So yeah, you can get cool stuff out of, there's such a thing as quantum billiards, you can get cool stuff out of it. Question of whether you could do this. So okay, whenever I think about stuff like this, I always run into the issue that it's sort of hard to see what you could get which is better than this. Because this abelianized local system is already a complete invariant. So if you ask yourself, can I get a stronger invariant, the answer is no. But yeah, I don't know. Like, yeah, it feels like you should be able to do this, sort of do a quantum version of this, and I have no idea what you would get or whether you would get anything extra.
The quantum spectrum.
Yeah. Oh, I never heard of that. That's cool. Okay. That I have no idea. I've never heard of it. That sounds cool. Now, I can say, okay, since you asked a sort of out there philosophical question, I can give you an out there philosophical answer, which is this: there's somebody named Sasha Shapiro at the University of Toronto, where I'm visiting from. Who? Sorry.
He spoke here a couple weeks ago.
Ah, great. So, in that case, he probably talked to you about quantum Teichmuller space. So, Fock-Gontrov coordinates, did he talk about quantum Teichmuller space or just like quantum moduli spaces of representations? The latter?
Kind of.
Oh, great, okay. In that case, I can just say, so you can take these moduli spaces of representations, which I've been talking about, of surface group representations, and quantize them. And so Sasha Shapiro is studying these quantized versions. And in particular, if you take representations that describe hyperbolic structures, you get a thing called quantum Teichmuller space, which I've heard described as sort of a baby version of quantum gravity. In other words, it's a quantum version of the moduli space of geometries for some manifold. And so you could then, yeah, you might, I mean, when you're taking these vectors and like, you know, carting them around on billiard balls, what you're doing is computing, you know, holonomies of some flat vector bundle, or if you want to be a physicist about it, you know, the like Wilson loops of some field. And so you can ask, okay, we know how to quantize the field. We can look at the quantum moduli space of representations, but we should have this field, of course, interacting with quantum particles as well. And that is precisely what you asked for. So yeah, sounds like somebody should get on that, but I don't know. All right. Other questions?
I suggest you take care and we'll continue with more questions.
All right. Thank you.